This is Abundance. I'm your host, Dane Allred. Each week on Abundance, we celebrate 1,001 things I'm thankful for from my list of 1,001 thanks. This week, names, number 643, is our topic. With our chapter 11 and 12 from The Plotter's Mile, and continue with our new feature in Abundance called Biography, and some episodes from A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to Dane Allred, and Dane Allred's Partly Colored Dream Coat. Funny thing happened on the way to Dane Allred. The Defender. The word champion can also be a verb, as in championing a cause, something you defend or stand up for. What will you champion this year? I will continue to champion the underdog, especially when I know there is unrecognized potential. Most of us champion one cause or another. Some of us are more vocal or strident in our support for our special cause, while many of us silently support things others may never suspect. While championing a cause is sometimes passed down in a family, most of the time we develop our pet projects as we make our journey through life, observing inequalities and the injustices we need to right. Sometimes we defend those who aren't able to defend themselves, and this kind of championing usually gets me in trouble. I step into many situations I should probably stay out of, and my wife usually advises me to stop, and she's usually right. We were in New York a couple of years ago, and when she stopped to photograph an amazing billboard, it pushed the crazy lady on the street to the limit. As a New Yorker, she'd probably had it with tourists stopping in the middle of the street to take photographs while she was on her way to her personality improvement class. She lost it and started shouting at my wife. "Go home," she demanded, and for some reason, I started yelling right back. "No, you go home," I said, which was kind of stupid if you think about it, because she probably lived in New York. She yelled, "Shut up," and with all the creativity I could muster, I shouted back, "No, you shut up." Pretty original. She started mumbling something, and I refused to back down. By this time, a crowd had gathered and was intently watching these two New York crazies. Well, I did my best, even though I was from Utah. I shouted something like, "Go away, nobody is listening to you," which really wasn't true, but again, when you're shouting at somebody on the street, nobody expects you to be brilliant. By this time, my wife had intervened and wanted me to move along. It was good advice, but defending my wife isn't the only person I like to defend. When I first became a teacher, I was amazed at the lack of faith most parents have in their own children. I found out that I had to be the defender and sometimes help them understand the potential of their own children. I need to explain about the classes I teach. At this time, it was a basic English class. It wasn't too hard to pass. I had several special needs students who were excused from doing some of the work, but many of them were able to complete assignments as well as regular students. And one particular student was missing several assignments, and I was having a parent conference with her. We were discussing the assignments she was missing and the fact that her grade was an F at the time. I was a brand new teacher, not used to the pessimism of some parents. I was flabbergasted when he announced in front of her that she was too stupid to be in my class. He continued by explaining how she couldn't do this kind of work and that it was his opinion she needed another class. You know, to say that I was stunned is an understatement, and for a moment I was speechless, but then I smiled at the student and I turned to defend her against the onslaught of her father. I told him she was doing very well on the other assignments she had completed. I also told him if she made up the missing work, she would pass the class. I even assured him she would probably get an A or B. He was momentarily stunned, but then began to insist there was no way she could succeed. And I, again, calmly and coolly insisted I had faith in her, and I would make sure she'd make up the work. And I stood to rise and left the conference. It was an amazing, dumbfounding, incredible thing to hear a parent call their own child stupid. Now, I'm not the world's best parent, but I don't think I ever did that. And if I did, I apologize. But my resolution to make sure this student passed my class was steeled. Maybe that was the plan, but I doubt it. He truly did believe his daughter was too stupid to do the work, even after I assured him her other work was fine. Again, my classes aren't the world's toughest, but my students learn. What she learned is I was her champion when no one else believed in her. And when she got a B in the class, no one was happier than me. You're listening to Abundance. Each week we celebrate one of the 1,001 things I'm thankful for. I still remember that girl's name. In just a moment, Biography Out Loud. All 33 selections from A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to Dane Allred are available on eBay and at DaneAllred.com. You can also read and listen to all of the episodes on DaneAllred.podbean.com or 1001thanks.blogspot.com, and you can download the selections on iTunes. Welcome to Biography Out Loud. I am your host, Dane Allred. Born in 1906, she knew William Wordsworth, Samuel Taylor Coleridge, Alfred Tennyson, Thomas Carlyle, Edgar Allan Poe, and was also married to a famous poet. Her poetry greatly influenced Elizabeth Emily Dickinson, and while she was already famous when she married, most people are more familiar with her married name. Who is this poet called one of the great Victorian writers? We'll find out in a moment on Biography Out Loud. Elizabeth Barrett is perhaps best known by her married name, Elizabeth Barrett Browning, but she was a famous poet before she married. At the age of 20, she became ill with an undiagnosed disease which left her weak and frail. She took morphine for the pain and eventually became addicted to the medication. Though her family was wealthy when she was born, reversals in the family fortune forced the sale of a large farm, and the end of slavery in Jamaica also affected the family income since a sugar plantation they owned was run by slave labor. During this time, Elizabeth Barrett became famous, rubbing shoulders with many other famous poets of the time. It was suggested by her physician she relocate nearer the ocean, and convincing her brother to accompany her, she later felt responsible for his death. He drowned in a sailing accident in Torquay on the Devonshire coast. A voracious reader and scholar, she learned Greek and Hebrew. In 1833, she published a translation of Prometheus Bound, a work by the great Greek dramatist Aeschylus. In 1842, she wrote a book of poetry called The Cry of the Children, which later influenced changes in child labor laws. In 1844, now a poet with a worldwide reputation, she received letters from Robert Browning which declared his love for her poetry. He met with her, and a great romance developed. He wrote 574 letters in the next 20 months. She was 6 years his senior and was not convinced of his devotion, detailing her doubts in the sonnets from the Portuguese. After a long courtship, they were married and went to live in Italy. Elizabeth was disowned by her father, who did the same to each of his children who married. She wrote of this time in her life, "The Mrs. Browning of popular imagination was a sweet, innocent young woman who suffered endless cruelties at the hands of a tyrannical papa, but who nonetheless had the good fortune to fall in love with a dashing and handsome poet named Robert Browning. She finally escaped the dungeon of Wimpole Street, eloped to Italy, and lived happily ever after." While in Italy, her health improved, and at the age of 43, she gave birth to their son, Penn. They were successful and lived comfortably in Italy, becoming local celebrities who were often stopped and asked for autographs. Edgar Allan Poe reviewed one of her poems and said, "Her poetic inspiration is the highest. We can conceive of nothing more august. Her sense of art is pure in itself." Inspired by her poem entitled Lady Geraldine's Courtship, Poe borrowed the meter of the poem and used it in The Raven. She later praised Poe's work on The Raven. After the death of William Wordsworth, it was thought that Elizabeth Barrett Browning might be named Poet Laureate, but Alfred Tennyson received the appointment. Her health failed again after the death of her father and sister. Weak and depressed, she died on June 29th, 1861. Buried in Florence, on Monday, July 1st, the shops in the section of the city around Casa Guida were closed while Elizabeth was mourned with unusual demonstrations. Perhaps her best-known poem is, "How Do I Love Thee? Let Me Count the Ways." In a letter to Mr. Chorley, a friend and critic, she said, "I never wrote to please any of you, not even to please my own husband." She also insisted she wrote from the heart and from an obligation to tell the truth. She once said, "Every genuine artist in the world goes to heaven for speaking the truth." In Sonnet 14, she asks to be loved for love's sake. Elizabeth Barrett Browning, Sonnet 14. "If thou must love me, let it be for naught except for love's sake only. Let it be for naught except for love's sake only. Do not say, I love her for her smile, her look, her way of speaking gently, for a trick of thought that falls in well with mine, and certes brought a sense of pleasant ease on such a day. For these things in themselves, beloved, may be changed, or changed for thee, and love so wrought may be unwrought so. Neither love me for thine own dear pity's wiping my cheeks dry. A creature might forget to weep who bore thy comfort long and lose thy love thereby. But love me for love's sake, that evermore thou mayest love on through love's eternity." Literature Out Loud, Cheerfulness, Taught by Reason, by Elizabeth Barrett Browning. I think we are too ready with complaint in this fair world of gods. How do we know hope indeed beyond the zenith and the slope of yon gray blank of sky? We might grow faint to muse upon eternity's constraint round our aspirant souls. But since the scope must widen early, is it well to droop for a few days consumed in loss and taint? Oh, pusillanimous heart, be comforted, and like a cheerful traveler, take the road singing beside the hedge. What if the bread be bitter in thine inn, and thou unshod to meet the flints? At least, it may be said, because the way is short. I thank thee, God.
PC Laptops, thank you for creating almost 100 local American jobs. We're hiring again! Are you sick of living in fear of being downsized at any moment? Are you one of those people that just add life to everyone you meet? Would you like to work for a company that gives full medical insurance benefits? Would you like to live a quality lifestyle in exchange for your great performance and good attitude? Would you like to work somewhere where you can call the CEO anytime you want to chat or have an idea? Are you a happy person who adds energy and all kinds of positive mojo to everyone you meet? Do you love technology and gadgets? Do you not smoke crack, smack, meth, or heroin? Then PC Laptops might have a job for you. We're hiring salespeople, PC and Mac techs who love computers and people and can fix them fast and precisely. Check out the job openings at PCLaptops.com. Because remember, at PC Laptops, we love you.
For years, Michael was a dairy farmer.
My dad had lived on a dairy farm. My mom was the daughter of the town banker.
But kidney failure kept him from living the life he dreamed of. Hundreds of people in your community are learning new job skills at Deseret Industries. When you donate goods to Deseret Industries, you give people like Michael a second chance.
I needed them to hire me so I could feel useful again.
Deseret Industries, getting the most out of what you've given.
Disney on Ice presents Worlds of Fantasy. It's high-speed action, undersea fun, wild adventure, and a magical new world. Your favorite stars from four fantastic Disney adventures come together in one amazing ice show. Go under the sea with Ariel, Sebastian, and Flounder from The Little Mermaid. Sing along with Simba, Timon, and Pumbaa from The Lion King. Join Lightning McQueen and his crew from Cars for the biggest drag race on ice. Then, enter the magical world of Pixie Hollow. It's the only place to see Tinkerbell and the Disney fairies live on ice. Disney on Ice presents Worlds of Fantasy.
Plus, come early to see Tiana, Disney's newest princess, and a dazzling display of gorgeous gowns at the Disney Princess Pre-Show, free to ticket holders. We've iced the price. Tickets starting at just $13. Restrictions may apply. See smithsticks.com for details. Playing Energy Solutions Arena March 10th through 14th.
Patience Taught by Nature by Elizabeth Barrett Browning. Oh, dreary life, we cry. Oh, dreary life. And still the generations of the birds sing through our sighing, and the flocks and herds serenely live while we are keeping strife with heaven's true purpose in us as a knife against which we may struggle. ocean girds, unslackened the dry land, savanna swards, unweary sweep, hills watch unworn, and rife meek leaves drop yearly from the forest trees to show above the unwasted stars that pass in their old glory. O thou God of old, grant me some smaller grace than comes to these, but so much patience as a blade of grass grows by, contented through the heat and cold. To Abundance in just a moment. Chapter 13 from The Plotter's Mile. Raymond Johnson and Tommy robbed a bank, leaving the cash on the train tracks. When John Graham found it and then made a fake package and took it to his friend, Captain Greg Jones, they knew something was up, but they called local reporter Paula Jones to help spread the news about the money. And when Raymond Johnson showed up, killed the deputy, wounded Captain Jones, and got both keys from them, and took the fake package, he was surprised when he found out not all the money was there. Ray Johnson is now wondering how soon he should go back to Ridgeway and try to find the rest of his money. The Plotter's Mile, Chapter 13. Schmitty met Greg at the station. The plan had worked too well, and now the bad guy knew he had been conned and probably wouldn't be too happy about the fact. Instead of catching him in the act, now the best they could do was to get an all points out on the still from the video camera in the station. Greg had enough sense to set the camera up right after the money had been locked away, but neither of them thought any of this would go down so fast. "Sorry, buddy," he began. "I didn't think you'd have to take the bullet for my stupid idea. I just thought he'd show up and try to be discreet about the whole deal. The worst news is that we haven't heard from your deputy, and this guy obviously had both keys. We better go check on him now." Greg sat silent for a moment and realized he hadn't even thought about Larry and all the commotion. He remembered seeing Larry's car at his house, but that had been the last time he thought about it. Greg suddenly had a very bad feeling. When they got to Larry's house, they were surprised to see the front door open, and so both officers went in with guns drawn. They didn't have to go far. As soon as they followed each other through that first door, Larry's body on the floor told the whole story. The pool of blood around his head had started to coagulate. Greg found he had to go back out the front door and gulp in some fresh air. Schmitty was right behind him. He muttered some words of comfort and then walked over to his car and called in the homicide. He hadn't looked closely, but the wounds looked very similar to Mike Shepard's. That meant they weren't just dealing with a robbery. This thief wasn't afraid to kill anyone to get his money back. Simon was sitting in his favorite chair. It was one of those Barkalander chairs with the handle on the side and the leg support that would flip up from the front. Several years ago, it had sprung a leak and some of the padding had started to sneak out. Now, it was mostly torn and ripped, with padding appearing more than what was once the blue material covering it. Simon didn't care, since he lived alone and was the only one who had to look at it. No one ever came to visit, either, so he never even really thought about replacing it. Simon just thought it was comfortable. He was watching his equally ancient television, which surprisingly was not black and white, but mostly color. Some of the colors weren't quite right, but that didn't bother him either. As long as he had a cold beer in his hand and his shotgun by his side, Simon felt all was right with the world. Then the news report came on the television. It was that lovely Paul Rogers again, one of Simon's favorite television people. Just because he was slightly over 70, there was no reason not to entertain the thought that this attractive young lady might see Simon as a desirable mate. He knew she was single, and with the wide-eyed optimism every man carries as standard equipment, Simon imagined himself a proper and eligible bachelor to any good-looking woman who had not yet turned him down. He knew he would probably not get the chance to propose, but it did make watching the television that much more interesting. At least he wasn't as fanatical about television as the wife had been. She was dead and gone now for over 15 years. While she was alive, she'd actually developed relationships with the people on the television, going so far as to tell Simon that if she didn't watch this show or that, then those poor people on the television would be insulted that she wasn't at her usual post. She'd been wacky. Paula Rogers was moving her mouth, and Simon was not really listening, but when the picture of Ray came on the screen, Simon sat up and turned up the volume. Apparently, Paula Rogers was reporting from just over the county line, still in Ridgeway. "Police are asking anyone who has information about Raymond Johnson to contact Harold Smith with the state police," she was saying. "He is considered armed and dangerous and is wanted in connection with the $100,000 robbery which happened at our state capitol recently. This is another Paula Rogers exclusive for WBHH." Simon recognized that guy's face. It was the man who Simon had seen earlier that day on the dirt road. The same guy who had driven out to the lake was wanted for armed robbery. Simon wasn't sure if there was a reward available, but to a man used to hunting crows and jackrabbits, the idea of bagging a bad guy who was just up the road was very appealing. Patting the shotgun by his side, Simon muttered, "Time to go to work, Bertha." Simon had named the shotgun after his dead wife years ago. John had finished his run and felt the marathon metaphor fit in very well with what was going on. He got in the house just in time to see the most recent Paula Rogers exclusive. "So that's what the guy looks like," John said to himself, not realizing Reba was standing in the kitchen nearby. She walked into the front room and turned to John. "You've heard of this guy before?" John stopped to think about what he could invent on the spur of the moment. "Yeah, this is the guy they think robbed that bank 2 days ago." Reba looked at his face, and it made John nervous. "He was right here in our town," she said. "Yeah, this is the guy who shot Greg, and probably the guy who murdered Larry," said John. "He also has Larry's car and probably his gun." "Why didn't they mention that in the story?" Reba wondered out loud, and John was happy to answer. "They probably don't want to panic the locals. He could still be in town, you know." Reba just chuckled. "Right. Where are you going to hide Larry's car in a small town like this?" she smirked. "I can see straight across town from our back door." John nodded his head and smiled. "Yeah, he's long gone." At least, that is what John was hoping. Ray sat sleeping peacefully in his car, enjoying the fresh country air and the gentle lapping of the waves on the shore. Next to the lake, he'd found a perfect place, which hid the car from anyone on the dirt road. It was practically impossible to find unless you were walking along the road and went around the turn. Parked under three massive trees, the car sat in the cool of the late afternoon. He was feeling quite lucky to have found such an ideal location, and even considered staying an extra day. If he wasn't getting so hungry, he probably would have been able to stay, but that was a nice thing about sleeping. Unless you were famished, sleep hid the growling stomach pains, and Ray hadn't slept at all last night. The lucid dreams he had as he rested by the side of the lake were also peaceful. Ray could see himself playing happily with his brothers in one of the few moments during their childhood when they weren't punching each other. It was one of the days Grandpa had come up to the coast to visit, and they were all sitting at the corner ice cream parlor trying to decide among 31 flavors. Grandpa had told them they could have anything on the menu, which, to adults, means the most expensive, but to children, means the biggest, as in three or four scoops stacked high. but which flavors to stack next to each other and in which order. The favorite flavor first or the last, so you could enjoy it after the others. Grandpa was very patient, and it always made Ray wonder how a patient and kind man like Grandpa could have such angry kids. That was how Ray always thought of his father. Angry. Angry enough to beat the boys regularly. Angry enough to leave scars. Thinking of his father led him to another dream, and it was at least as painful to leave the wonderful ice cream dream as it was to recall the pain inflicted on him by his father. Ray could see the belt being drawn quickly through the belt loops, which signified impending pain. This beating was one of the last Ray had suffered at his father's hands. It was so vivid, Ray was flinching in his sleep as the belt flashed across his back and buttocks. Then Ray could see his own back in his dreams, with blood oozing through his shirt. Time slowed as the blood crawled across his back, and a close-up of the material from his shirt turned from yellow to a darkish, brownish red. Ray could see his father dropping the belt to his side, looking at the blood on Ray's back, and then more slow motion as his mother ran into the picture, grabbing Ray from his father. It had been the next week they were all placed in a foster home. Ray had always thought it was his fault his family was broken up. If he had only been good enough not to deserve the beating, then there would have been no evidence to damn his parents. His dreams moved from one foster home to another, some good, some bad. The memories washed over him as he seemed to float farther and farther away from his family. He remembered fondly when Mrs. Anderson had sat home with him when he was sick, sitting by the bed comforting him, stroking his hair and pulling up the covers. Ray could feel the blankets getting tucked in around his waist. But this time, Mrs. Anderson kept adjusting the blankets, and it felt like she was poking him in the side now. Simon was poking him in the side with the shotgun. Ray slowly awakened to feel something much harder than blankets pushed against his ribs. "Get out of the car," said Simon, "real slow." You're listening to Abundance. Today we've examined some of the life of Elizabeth Barrett Browning, heard a few of her poems, and chapter 13 of A Plotter's Mile. I hope you're enjoying this wonderful day, and that you're as thankful for all of the bounty in your life as I am for the bounty in mine. It's 40 minutes past the hour. The Plotter's Mile, Chapter 14. Paula was sitting in the corner of Greg's front room crying. Greg had done his best to try to comfort her, but this time it wasn't about him, and he wasn't making much headway. "I'm hurting people, Greg," she wept. "Just like when you got shot. Now people are watching over their shoulders for this Raymond Johnson guy, and who knows who he'll shoot next. The last words out of their mouths will be, "You're that guy Paula Rogers was talking about on the news." And she began crying again. "Come on, Paula," said Craig. "Where's that tough blonde I saw interview that serial killer? And how about that child pornographer? Those were harder than this case." Paula shook her head. "The serial killer didn't kill anyone I knew. I led this guy Ray to this city, and now Larry is dead, and you've been shot." Greg was finally beginning to get that this was more than just being about the violence against people she had known, but that Paula was feeling personally responsible, like an accessory to the crime. Greg had been trained about what to do when witnesses began to feel guilty by association, so he kicked it into high gear. "Look at me, Paula." She stopped whimpering and sniffed. She looked up. "You didn't do this. He did. If you had told me you didn't want to do the story, I would have called until I found somebody who would do it. Plus," he said as soothingly as he could, "there is no way we can control what others do. We can only control what we do." This was probably the wrong thing to say to her. She pushed up her sleeves, squared her shoulders, and said directly to his face without hesitation, "That's why I'm going to quit the broadcasting business. Then I won't be hurting anyone else." John was back to making lists. He was feeling so confident that his luck would hold, he had decided to prioritize his wish list. Just a few things for himself, like a jet ski or a motorcycle. Then a few things for Reba, like the hot tub she was always talking about. Maybe a diamond bracelet or an Alaskan cruise. It didn't hurt that he could also use Reba's gifts, except the bracelet. He almost crossed it off. College tuition for the kids. Maybe a cabin. Maybe the rest in savings. $100,000 didn't go as far as John hoped it would. As John was scribbling away on his list, his principal came in and tapped on the open door. "Can we talk for a minute, John?" "Sure, Scott." He cleared a space for his boss to sit. "Sorry for the mess." John's office was always cluttered with scripts, assignments, and books. Scott always got right to the point. "Everything all right? I mean, is this shooting and murder thing interfering with your classes?" John smiled. "I have become the celebrity of the day, and everyone wants to hear the story. It mostly interfered with my lunch today." Scott chuckled. "So much for duty-free lunch, huh? Everyone wants to hear all the details?" "Yeah, and the kids keep trying to get me to talk about it," John said. "Well, you look like hell, but keep up the good work," Scott said. "I know you won't let this stuff affect your work." And that was that. Scott was all business and hadn't even asked anything about the gory details that were spreading around town, especially the rumor about Ray and some kind of ice pick. Scott trusted John. John trusted himself and went back to making his list, thinking for a minute he really should get back to grading those papers. But maybe he would jot down just a few items more for the kids while he still remembered them. Ray didn't like being tied up, but here he was on the ground, eating the dust from the dirt road, and Simon was hog-tying him, literally. Just when Ray thought he might be able to knock the gun from Simon's hands, he was already tied. "Nice knot, eh?" said Simon. "I was the all-around cowboy champion, mostly because I could tie up a doggy in less than 2 seconds." "Who the hell cares how you tie up your dogs?" Ray spat out, also spitting out mud. Simon just laughed. "A doggy is a calf. You jump off a horse and knock it to the ground and tie up its legs, just like you're tied up now. Now get on your feet and start walking down the road." "What makes you think I'll stay anywhere close to where you tell me to go?" insisted Ray. "What's to stop me from just running into the woods?" Simon spat some tobacco onto the ground. "Well, Bertha, that's my shotgun here, makes a pretty wide spread, so I don't have to shoot so exact as you and your fancy pistol here." Simon crammed Larry's gun into his overalls. "Plus, you can run through the woods if you want, but that's just the kind of noise a deer makes, and the black bears come running when they hear that." Simon decided to let some of this sink in. Ray decided to be quiet too, but was now looking nervously into the nearby trees. "So, start walking, and I'm going to drive your car behind you," said Simon. "I'll have my gun poked out the window, and yes, I do shoot left-handed. You can stop when you get to my house, about 1 mile, straight ahead." Ray looked back at the old man, who was now sitting behind the wheel, with the barrel resting on the doorframe, pointed straight at Ray. The car started up, and Ray recognized that it was time for a strategic retreat, like when he let his brothers think he was really hurt in a fight. When they came up to get him to stop crying, he would jam his knee into their groin. This old farmer would get his own wake-up call soon. Schmitty was thinking out loud, trying to help Greg tie up all the loose ends that didn't make sense. They'd been blindsided by Larry's murder, never anticipating that robbery would turn so deadly. "So the guy gives up his dim-witted friend so he can keep the money," Schmitty said. "Then he makes up a fake bundle to throw under the train, which is found and turned into you." Greg grimaced. "It just doesn't make sense, does it? I mean, why kill Larry for his key and shoot me just to get the last 1800? Schmitty waited while Greg connected the dots. "Unless he didn't keep the rest of the money," muttered Greg. "Unless the rest of the money is somewhere here in town." Schmitty was nodding, but still said nothing. Greg's eyes got wide. "John Graham has the rest of the money?" Schmitty finally spoke. "I suspected it the first time you called, but since he's a close friend, I didn't want to alert you to the possibility. But remember, I did tell you to get some surveillance on him." Greg slapped his forehead. "Because you thought Raymond Johnson might connect the dots, too. He would be here in town to get the money from John. He would be here to get it any way he could, including killing one of my friends." Schmitty jumped in. "And I think he'll be back soon as he finds out the package is a little light. Is there somewhere we can set up and watch John Graham's house without him knowing?" This time Greg was nodding. "Well, there's an old house across the street that has been empty for the past year. I can talk to the owner. We can camp out there," Greg said. Then he began shaking his head. "What?" said Schmitty. "I can't believe I didn't see it. Just because it's someone I've known practically my whole life, it's a rookie mistake. I should have seen it," Greg said. "But it wouldn't have made any difference. And if you had known," said Schmitty, "who knows if you would have waited for the bad guy to come to town. The bank might get the money back earlier, but we would have lost Raymond Johnson forever." Raymond Johnson was lost somewhere out in the country. Simon knew where he was going, but following Ray in the car wasn't the same as leading him to the house, so Ray just kept walking, hoping that sometime soon they would get there, and that Ray could kill this stupid bastard and then get back to his money. Simon could guess where Ray's thoughts were turning. "Hell," he thought to himself, "if someone came up and stuck me in the ribs with a gun, hogtied me, and then made me march up the road, I'd want to kill him too." The old farmer had dealt with plenty of angry animals in his life, including those who hadn't especially wanted to be castrated at that moment. Simon wondered if this guy would scream like those little pigs used to. Then Ray saw the house. The car was slowing behind him, and Ray could tell that Simon was planning on parking out by the front door, which gave him the opportunity to play dumb. He kept walking, and Simon shouted out, "That's far enough. Stay right there." Ray waited to hear the brakes applied and figuring that stopping the car and shooting at the same time wouldn't be so easy if you were as old as the hills, he ran around the side of the house. A shot rang out just behind him as he turned the corner, and Ray heard Simon curse as buckshot peppered the side of his house. Ray ran into the barn just behind the house and tried quickly to find something to cut the ropes on his wrists. Simon was out of the car just around the corner when he saw Ray go into the barn. "This is getting fun," he thought to himself. But then he remembered the pitchfork, the saw, and other sharp tools he usually kept stored back there in the barn. Ray would want him to run into the barn so he could stab him, he reasoned, so the best thing to do was to wait. The entire barn was visible from the back of the house, and unless this crook ran straight back from the barn, Simon would be able to see him come out. So Simon pulled out the rocker from the back porch and settled in. It was still an hour before it would get dark, and he could always call the police any time he wanted. There was no back door to the barn, and only a small window. And if this youngster wanted to take on old Bertha by running from the front door to the back of the barn, Simon was ready to oblige. But Simon figured he hadn't lived more than 70 years and not learned a trick or two, and learned to be especially patient. He figured Ray would be coming out eventually. Dane Allred's Partly Colored Dream Coat. A rose is a rose. What's in a name? That which we call a rose by any other name would smell as sweet. William Shakespeare. The world is full of so many different kinds of people. There is no way we can ever hope to know them all. We can know of a people, of a group. We categorize by geography. We think we know a people because we know of their country. We think of different ethnic groups and say all people in that group are alike. Nothing could be further from the truth. As we learn to know people as individuals, we find out each person is unique and special in their own way. After we get to know a person even better, we can no longer classify them by color, race, ethnic group, or any other label. They become our friends. Accepting others really isn't that hard. Ask a few questions and find out about their lives, and soon we learn we share more commonalities than differences. We all have a mother. We all have a father. And those two reference points give everyone a chance to share their joys, sorrow, and the history of being a son or a daughter. We all have youth and mature into old age. The fears and hopes may vary from one person to another, but again, if we take the time to learn about each other, we will find we are all brothers and sisters. When we think about the creation stories from all around the world, the commonality is that we are all descended from common ancestors, and we truly are brothers and sisters. Trace back your family history far enough, and we're all related. Even people we may not want to be related to are probably a closer relative than we may want. What's in a name? The sweetest sound in the world. Knowing someone's name is a good indicator of how much we care about them. Do we consider the people who wait upon us as less important? Are those who work in less important jobs than ours less important people? Do we only know the names of our bosses? Why do we worship those who are famous or infamous and repeat their names with reverence to each other? Are movie stars and the wealthy really better than anyone else? I've rubbed shoulders with many people who are household names as famous actors and actresses. They really are, just like you and me. I try to explain this to people I know, and they look at me as if I'm from another planet. Don't I know they're famous? Don't I know I should quake in the presence of the famous and nearly famous? It really is a strange thing to realize. We are all more similar than different. And those who we revere were just in the right place at the right time for an opportunity. You know what I'm talking about, even though you want to deny it. There are people in your life who have better jobs, houses, cars, and it's not because they're more talented, more blessed, or more deserving. In fact, I'll bet you can think of several people you believe don't deserve the recognition or worldly possessions they have. Did they get these things by being more talented? Perhaps. Were they more deserving or just lucky? Perhaps. But they really are no different than you and I, even though it seems hard to believe. Here's another way to explain what I'm trying to tell you. Think of those who succeeded in spite of being disadvantaged, disfigured, or disabled. Helen Keller, Thomas Edison, Oprah Winfrey, Bill Gates, even Ralph Lauren. Almost two-thirds of the world's 946 billionaires made their fortunes from scratch. Some were orphans. Think of the success story of J.K. Rowling, the author of the highly successful Harry Potter series. A single mother on welfare can succeed. We all have so much talent, aptitude, and untapped potential. There is a future success in every person we meet. How can we discount any one of them as less important, less worth knowing, too insignificant to know their name? Please don't tell me you're bad at names. That old excuse is worse than claiming bad luck is the reason for failure. If you really want to know someone's name and remember it, you will. Say their name to them when you hear it. Use their name as you speak with them. Try to remember and ask again if you forget. Or think of it this way. Who was the last person who remembered your name you were unhappy about them remembering? They cared enough to remember your name. Can you do the same? There is an easy way to show you care for someone else. Learn their name.